welcome along to the Short Baller Rugby Pass podcast. Scotty Stevenson with you. No Millsy today, he's all fishing. So we've got Simon Porter, CEO of CSM, the largest sports agency in New Zealand, and representatives of a number of our top footy players. Simon, amongst other things, welcome to the pod, mate. Great to have you here.
Thank you.
I thought we'd get you along today. Seeing Millsy's away, we could actually get serious for a change. And it's that funny time of the season, especially in this part of the world, where a lot of things are going down. A lot of boys are re-signing. A lot of teams are shoring up their squads long term. And I know that your company especially is right in the thick of that, as are others. So paint us a picture of why this time of the year, first of all, is a genuinely busy time.
Well, I guess you can probably sum it up. We're in a global marketplace. And as much as we like it or we don't, the people with the biggest cannons are residing in the northern hemisphere. They're reaching the business end of their season. Their contracts run, it's a little bit different everywhere, but effectively 1 July to 30 June. So we're actually getting to the back end of when they're doing their shoring up and they're looking forward to where they want to be next season. Mm. You know, they've had the domino effect of somebody leaving, you know, the Saints to go to Saracens or Clermont to go to Toulon. And so they need to work out what they're doing, the retirements, natural attrition, et cetera, et cetera. So that slowly but surely has driven our contracting window as such, or when teams have to make their decisions, much earlier in the season, which isn't ideal, particularly from a team point of view and sometimes from a player point of view, because they're being asked to make decisions before they can have a real good understanding of where they might stand international selection or where they stand within their team, etc. But we're in a global marketplace and that's just the way the cookie crumbles.
So give us a bit of background about you and your experience in this line of work. Trained lawyer, and I believe, Simon, you started out with a big firm. Yeah. And we're looking at ways to maybe share your passion with your career. You're a former rugby player, a representative rugby player for both North Otago here provincially and for Counties Monaco. So you had an affinity for the game for starters. What drove you to look at sports lawyering as a career?
About 12 bottles of Spates with wine and alcohol. When I went to university, I started university in 96, the first year of Super Rugby. Never before had I ever imagined that or thought that you could mix your intellectual endeavours or your academic endeavours with your sporting passions. They were always quite separate. And then I kind of, you know, as I worked through my law degree and my footy started going okay, it kind of came with the realisation, I can't remember, I'll probably throw a prop to the old man. I'm sure my old man planted the seed in my head and sort of said, well, one day, mate, you might be able to combine these two, you know, the way it's going with sports law. And I was lucky enough to be approached by Warren Alcock, who is still, you know, the most active agent in the game nowadays. And he offered me a gig working for him doing sports law, which, you know, straight out of law school was a pretty cool thing to walk straight into. And then I hopped around a little bit, went to Balgully for a bit, but worked with Andrew Scott-Howman a little bit, who does a lot of the Players Association work, does a lot of work with the FIFA stuff as well. He's really heavily involved in the football side of things. So I always had a sporting element, and then get to talk code for a living, mate. So it's not too bad.
Yeah, you do it well, from my experience. But the sports agent, I know that still a lot of people have this picture of the Jerry Maguires, Bob Sugars in their head about what an agent is. From my experience dealing with you guys, it's not quite that glitzy and not quite that glamorous, but it's a lot of hard work. Just how tough is it to represent these athletes, given the Byzantine regulations around sports contracts, player associations, collective bargaining, etc.?
Yeah, well, it's a lot of detail. It's not stuff on a whim. There is a lot of regulation to get your head around, whether it be World Rugby regulations, whether it be, you know, collective agreements in each of the countries, or it's transfer windows, or it's eligibility regulations, or it's whatever. So there is, a lot of, you know, legal or regulatory stuff that you have to get your head around. But it's not glamorous, I think, because, I mean, the people we're dealing with are just ordinary blokes. I mean, you count a lot of them as friends. When you get to know these people on such a level, you know, you kind of get a bit desensitized to the glitz and glamour you see them, because you're dealing with their everyday problems. They you know, you're very privileged. They welcome you into their world to help them make decisions. And you kind of, you know, as it's evolved, you become much more of a guidance counselor than anything else. You know, just helping guys sort their decisions, you know, sort out their minds, get them asking themselves what's important to them, what's important to their family, what are they going to regret, what aren't they going to regret, what drives them, what's going to get them out of bed. If they do go overseas, you know, on that snowy, you know, Onyx day, what's you know, whereas here there's that one dream that sits like a beacon at the corner of their room that gets them out every day. So, you know, you really do. And then when you're, you know, we're increasingly dealing with younger athletes, which is great. To start with, I was quite sort of skeptical about that, but seeing the value that you can add, or the comfort that you can give them and their family around they are making a good decision, you are getting much more into, okay, well, what do you want to study? You know, where can you do that? What's, you know, like, so it's evolved a lot, even in the sort of 11, 12 years where I've sort of just been doing it full time.
Well, we've known each other for the best part of a decade. And I want to pick up on that point, because one of the fundamental changes that you've gone through in your career is the age issue. There was a time where you would start picking up professional athletes at about the age of 19, 20. Now we're seeing kids stipended at 15, and sometimes noticed much younger than that. And as an agency, it falls on you guys to make sure that you're in the conversation for their representation. I know we've spoken about this at length over the years, about how problematic it can be when suddenly you find yourself not at a provincial game but at a schoolboy game, and you've got to deal with a whole different kind of athlete and their families and kids who are too young to be signing contracts. So how have you adjusted as an agent, as a manager and as a lawyer to the growing need to be representing athletes at a much younger stage?
Yeah, well, I mean, we concentrate on rugby union, and as a general rule, rugby union, and I'll call it rugby, hasn't really gone too young, you know, they haven't started to approach the 14 and the 15 year olds. It really is the guys that kind of make the under 18 program, who'll be either the exceptional year 12s, I think mm-hmm. it's form 6, and the year 13s. And I mean, my personal view is that it's year 13, anybody who comes through school has to make a decision at that point. Are they going to seek a trade? Are they going to go overseas? Are they going to work? Are they going to go to university? What are they going to study? That is the time that we should be asking these young athletes to make their minds up. And that is generally, rugby respects that. There's been a few instances recently where, you know, maybe some unions or some clubs or provincial unions, etc., have wanted to make a guy make a decision a little bit earlier. But I think in the main, rugby accepts that it's kind of that last year of school is when you should be trying to make those decisions.
Well, we had the issue just recently with a young player who was contracted
yep.
to the Warriors, who yep. decided, no, I want to play sevens for New Zealand. So are we going to see issues like that increasingly in our game, or do you think that that's become a bit of a touchstone for the entire business to say, look, you know, maybe we have to have a look at ourselves and our contracting models about when these things are appropriate?
Well, mate, I think, as with anything in this game, it's about the money, right? And it's about the money that you have at your disposal. And the fact is that the rugby league clubs have got untold resources, and they can afford to take punts on a whole lot more, a whole larger number of potential athletes than rugby union can, simply because they've got more money. Like, I mean, what were the stats out of the under 20 competition in league? It was something like three or four on average from the under 20 team actually made it
to first grade.
To first grade.
And yet they've all got very big active under 20 programs.
Yep. They're gone now. They've changed that this year. And so there's not going to be as many people contracted in league, but there's going to be the same amount of money for less people. So the problem's going to become even greater. Whereas union does put money into these guys through, you know, Harbour under 16s or Auckland under 16s or the under 14 program or the under 18 program or whatever it is, but they just don't have that extra money to say, well, we're actually going to run an academy that goes well down deep and we're going to spend $500,000 on it a year. Whereas for league, who salary caps 9.5 million Australian, they get funded 120% of the salary cap through broadcast rights. So that's an extra 2 million to spend on
whatever you want. Yeah.
What are you going to spend it on? Shoring up your own so you don't have to pay them so much when you get them to change from other clubs. So it's if union can get to the point where, you know, they've got enough money to be able to do that, well, they'll probably do it.
Yeah.
And you think about football, which is the worst case over in, well, not the worst case, but where it's the most developed, where they're, you know,
12-year-old kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they've got the money.
Yeah, that's right.
It's something like 0.01% of people that go through academies actually end up as full-time professionals, but 1% or something.
That's right. But this is the thing. I can understand it from an NCAA perspective, where you've got similar numbers coming out of college sports, especially the big sport football, college football, making it to the NFL. But they're generating enormous revenues in the meantime. It's not about developing players for the professional leagues. It's about a business unto itself. That's very different with rugby union as it currently stands, with rugby league as it currently stands.
Yep.
Your big show is first grade, is senior level.
Yep.
So is this about keeping players in the game for as long as possible, rather than them looking and saying, you know what, I'm just going to go do something else, because, you know. So is it about being able to say to the youngsters, there is a pathway here, even if the percentage is low, we're going to give you hope?
That's probably romantic. Ideally, that's what it is. We're going to give you hope. I mean, I don't know too many, you know, I know a lot of the people and they're all good people, but, you know, they are driven by what's good for their club, you know, just...
Which is numbers, ultimately. Yeah, participation numbers, right?
Yep, that's right. So I think, yeah, I mean, it's important, particularly in union, that we maintain the broad base that we have and the participants, and we need the young kids because that's where the fans come from, and we need the adolescents to, you know, to keep playing the game, be they boys or girls. We need a big base there, so we need to make sure we maintain that balance between a game for all New Zealanders, I think is the catch cry, versus a game for very few, where if you're not picked up by 13 or 14 or 15 in a professional program,
you're done.
That's it, you're done. We have to fiercely protect that game for all New Zealanders, I think, because we need that base.
That's a really interesting point you raise around the youth now in our game, but also you've been at the forefront of professional contracting as New Zealand players leave for overseas clubs, for an experience in France, for whatever reason. And we've seen a growth in that, and we'll stay with the age thing, because this has become a real talking point around our game. Are we seeing New Zealand kids going at a much younger age, or is it just there are so many more opportunities that was always going to be the case? Is it a change in the way that kids think about staying in New Zealand, or is it just a case of having many more opportunities now?
I don't really buy into that we are starting to lose 18, 19, 20-year-olds from our game. It happens occasionally, but I don't. Personally, as somebody that's...
Well, you would know. You see it,
at the
right?
forefront. I don't really see it. We definitely lose, you know, union players to league, 15, 16, 17 sort of thing, when they do sign these agreements of some
development agreements, yeah.
With league clubs in Australia. But in the main, you know, I think the average age of the person that went overseas, there's been some research on it, is about 25, you know, roughly. So, but what, undoubtedly, back to your question, yes, players are much more aware of opportunities overseas, of what rugby's like overseas, of what their values are overseas, or they're more inquisitive about it. Now, I reckon the reasons for that, the world's got smaller with social media, and it's much easier to keep in touch with, you know, your 5/8 partner who left last year, and he's telling me, it's awesome over here, mm-hmm. It's great, you know, I'm getting this. And the boys are probably a bit more freer about, you know, letting people know what they get paid, and the media are better at finding it out and all that sort of stuff. But more guys are realising that there is you know, another world out there, and if they're not in all that contention, that some of them think, well, shit, I might as well go get paid.
Yeah.
And you can't, can you blame them for that? Well, not really, I don't think. It's just kind of natural. I think the one thing one of the big things that doesn't really ever get talked about, but losing, Mitre 10 Cup used to be a wonderful thing where guys used to get paid a ridiculous amount of money to do very little amounts of work. We'll be honest about it. But it was a way to prop up salaries in New Zealand. And so guys that used to be able to earn 80K playing Super Rugby are now having to, play
Mitre 10 Cup.
Mitre 10 are now only getting 25, 30. And so if they miss out on Super Rugby, they used to be getting 80 to live in Invercargill or Napier or whatever, and now they're only getting 25, but they know. And so back then, 4,000 or 5,000 euros a month from Narbonne wasn't that attractive. Well, now you get to be a full-time professional player,
live in a different part of the world.
Or I can earn 30 grand here, you know, like,
nothing wrong with Invercargill though. That's not the point you're making.
That's not the point. No, you live like a king in Invercargill. That's not the point I'm making at all. I threw Hawke's Bay in there as well, just to balance it out.
Yeah, I guess it's a strange thing, because in many ways, and again, you've been at the tip of this, we've seen the money's paid increase in certain ways, certainly for our top players, exponentially.
Yep.
And we always talk about the overseas experience as if it is predicated purely upon a paycheck, and I disagree with that. I don't think, and New Zealanders are probably a lot more polite than some nations when it comes to researching people's salaries and talking about that sort of issue. There are some extraordinarily well-paid athletes in our game in this country who don't have to look overseas, who might be offered, as was reported, Beauden Barrett, here's your $3 million a season. I think Beauden Barrett's pretty comfortable in New Zealand without having to pack up his life and go. I mean, we can't compete with that as a sport in this country, and it would be ridiculous to think we could. But there are so many ways, I guess, and I'd love you to sort of shine some light on this, and how we keep our top talent here when we cannot compete on paycheck alone.
Yeah. So, it's environment that, you know, the Super Rugby clubs do wonderful jobs of creating that real, you know, that people want to hang around, they want to play, they create really good environments for the boys. We do have world-class coaching, you know, I don't think. You know, we do have the best coaches in the world, and I think everybody who's out there trying to get New Zealand coaches probably proves that. We manage our players pretty well. I think the problem in New Zealand rugby is the haves and the have-nots, kind of, a little bit. And if you're an All Black, you get managed really well, right? Mm. You get a nice big end-of-season break. You don't have to go through the full rigmarole of a pre-season. You're not expected to start firing until a little bit later. You know, there are nice rests during the Rugby Championship, etc. If you're a Super Rugby player, you know, good player, real add value to your team, but you're not quite in that sphere, well, you've got to play all your Super Rugby games, and you're probably playing a lot of minutes.
Yeah.
You then roll, and if you go deep into the competition, you roll straight into 10 games of Mitre 10 Cup.
George Bridge is a prime example. Yeah. I mean, he's a kid who last year, I think, played 38 games of rugby.
Yeah. You know, so we do talk about how our guys play less, but that's how All Blacks play less than everybody else. Mm. We're a little bit out of kilter down there. But so we do compete on environment. That's what keeps people here. Super Rugby, I think, is the most fun competition for these guys to play, and it's the most, you know, attacking, vibrant, you know, game of rugby. I mean, it just looks so cool.
Like, yeah, it does.
Like, I'd love to play rugby these days. You get there, you get to throw it around.
I'd love to watch you play rugby.
But it would. I'd be in the Northern Hemisphere because I'd still be catch and kick. But that's right. But it looks fun. You know, you see the smiles on these guys' faces.
They're having a good time.
And they are having a whale of a time. They're expressing, you know, it's a cliche, but they're expressing themselves. They're doing all that sort of stuff. We're scoring lots of tries. We're not just taking penalties. We're not kicking the corners. You can have a go from under your own sticks if you want. You know, like,
well, and here's another point to raise, because, you know, you talk about environment. Part of that environment is these guys are really passionate about rugby, but not every game of rugby is equal. Not every team plays the same style of rugby. I think there's a lot of our guys who stay in New Zealand because they know they're playing the very best rugby in the world. And Northern Hemisphere listeners may choose to argue with that. That's fine. But I think that is the opinion of our guys. And speaking to a lot of them who have experienced French club rugby, English Premiership Rugby, Heineken Cup or European Cup these days, they know that there are some games there that are a grind. Conditions are a grind. The style's a grind. It's a very traditional fixture. They love coming here and playing open, running, attacking footy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So that is what keeps a lot of the guys here. But then when it comes to when they go overseas, I mean, it could just be a multitude of factors. Mm. It's not always about the money. Sometimes it's just a desire, I've had enough. You know, I just want to do something else. I just want to go.
Well, my partner wants to go live somewhere. Yeah, so I've got a young family and this is my chance. Yeah.
Before they, a lot of it comes in, a lot of them, it's before my kids go to school. Right, this is my window to go. I think, yeah. And I mean, money, you can't hide the fact that money is, you know, normally a very strong.
It's a good motivator.
It's a very good motivator.
Yeah.
But it's not the only motivator. But when guys get up there, like you talk about, yes, we have the most enjoyable rugby to play, and you talk about your Northern Hemisphere listeners. I don't think Super Rugby is the best competition. I think it's the most enjoyable rugby.
Mm.
But, you know, I have the pleasure of getting to watch rugby all around the world, and going and watching a premiership game,
going to
watch a top 14 game, it is such a wonderful match day experience. And that's where I think New Zealand probably gets a little bit, we get a little bit caught up in how good our rugby is and our product. The product for me as a paying spectator
is the match occasion. Day experience. Yeah, the occasion. I couldn't agree with you more on that. And that is the feedback we get all the time. Certainly you would from your clients, I would from clients of yours who, you know, have been stationed overseas. They love that experience of playing in a Toulouse-Toulon game or playying a Leicester-Saints game or any time anyone beats Saracens. I mean, you know, like these are amazing occasions. And
crowds like La Rochelle's got something like 14,500 seats in their stadium.
Hmm.
Guess how many season tickets they've got?
Oh, probably about 15,000.
14,000 season tickets. They could oversubscribe, but they need to give 500 to let the community experience rugby.
Right. That's incredible, right?
Every day knowing that you're going to go and play. It's only, you know, bespoke stadiums that awesome environments with their songs and their dancing. And then you hang around and you have barbecues afterwards and they have bands playing and the players all mill through. And you're a member. You're a member and you get treated as a member. And that's just where that's where our disconnect is. And I know a lot of teams, clubs are aware of it.
And trying really hard.
Yeah. And that's the other thing, just, you know, listeners out there who, you know, sit there and moan about players going overseas, buy a ticket. Come and watch more rugby. Mm. If you really want to make a difference, because that is how we get money directly into the game, is more bums on seats.
But also how you keep the excitement factor alive for the players. No player I know likes playing in front of 1,000 people in an empty stadium. Yeah. It's just that because they don't feel like they're in a big league. I agree with that. Another point I want to touch on, you and I have had a fair bit to do with women's rugby, certainly over the last 5 years. Are you directly connected through your wife, Hannah, who both represented New Zealand and now works as part of the management team for the Black Ferns. The growth in the women's game, and we've both championed that, you because you have to, otherwise Hannah will kick you out. And because I think we both believe in it. We both believe in what these women are trying to achieve.
Yeah.
The professional contract for you, is that a turning point for the women's game or at least a starting point for where they can take this sport?
Oh, it's a big step. It's a turning point. It's a starting, you know, it's the starting point, but there's lots to come. You know, like, I don't think my wife will mind. You know, we get home last night. I get home from work last night. First thing she says to me, Warriors have got a NRL team. You know, like, we've got to do something. We've got to give these girls a competition to play in. We've got to come up with something just for all those reasons we talked about, for the men and why they stay in New Zealand, because it's the best competition, the best coaching. They feel they get better. All that stuff that's, you know, that is just beaten into us, that, you know, the high performance sort of element. We need to reproduce that, otherwise we're not going anywhere.
I agree. Here's the concern. New Zealand has been well known and respected for the respect we've afforded our women in sport over a long period of time. But Australian Rules now is probably the biggest investor in netball clubs in Australia. Yep. That is a growth game. And they've got a professional women's league in Australian Rules Football, the NRL. Off the back of a sponsor threatening to pull out until they got it sorted.
Yep.
Rugby Union, exactly the same, trying to sort something in Australia. Is a march been stolen on New Zealand here? Because these sports around the world are going to be populated with New Zealand female athletes.
Yep. They are. Yeah, well, they are, yes. They are, absolutely. And now, unfortunately, we're in a situation we've got to be reactionary and not, you know, we're not being proactive. And I don't think, you know, when you're reactive, you never make the best decision. You make the decisions that you have to make, don't you, that are in front of you, and you know, you're not in control. So I feel New Zealand rugby has a lot of competing interests that they have to, you know, they have to look after. But, I mean, I wrote an article for the spin-off last year.
That's right.
With some nice help from someone. but at the end of the day, I just genuinely think they've got a free pass. They've got a free pass, and if we have to cut money out of another part of the game, we just have to do it. It's simply the right thing to do. It's the right thing to do.
Do you know what makes financial sense to me? Right, and I've heard all the arguments and sat there shaking my head at pubs and over a beer and at games. People don't want to watch women's rugby. I just call bullshit on that. You know, I've got a real build it and they will come philosophy. Yep. You're talking about 50% of the population.
Yep.
That's what we're talking about. Why would you not be investing in this and saying, if this is the game for all New Zealanders, then this is what needs to happen? And I know that New Zealand rugby will say we're trying, we're just trying to make it work financially. I know we're in a very small market compared to some, and we've spoken today on the pod about the difference between the money power of the North and what we have. But if Across the Ditch can do it, we can do it.
Yeah, particularly where rugby is, where rugby financially is.
That's right.
Financial. I mean, we're not going to compete with the NRL. We're not going to compete with the AFL, which, you know, the money's just, you know, extraordinary.
It is.
But if the Australian Rugby Union can do it, then New Zealand can do it. And look, though, to be fair, we do have the Farah Palmer Cup, so we do have a competition. So it's not that there isn't a competition, and there has been for a long time, etc. It's probably just, I mean, there's a reason New Zealand wanted Super Rugby. It's because the window of when they played the men's game didn't suit, and it wasn't the most attractive, etc. So you can't flog that dead horse and think it's going to work for the girls. You've actually got to come up with something and, you know, play it in the stadiums at better times.
Correct.
Don't say nobody turns up to test matches and put test matches on at 2:30 on a Wednesday afternoon. Well, of course nobody's going to come. Everybody's at work. You wouldn't play the All Blacks then. You know, like, it's just thinking through some of those things. Otherwise, it just becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. There are some things that can be done that don't cost money, just by having a better awareness and a better understanding and a better look at it to say, well, that's just the right thing to do. Or it didn't work for the men. Well, how can we expect, what's the definition of insanity? Or is it,
yeah,
you know, doing the same thing
over and over again, expecting a different outcome? That's right. Simon Porter, CEO of CSM, New Zealand's leading player agency, joining us on The Short Ball today. And we'll wrap things up pretty soon, Simon. But I do want to talk about some personal anecdotes in your line of work. It's not always plain sailing. And there are players who decide to go somewhere and don't like it.
Yep.
And it falls to you to try to extract, perhaps, or to transfer that player, or to make sure that they're happy.
Yep.
What's been, if you can talk about it, and you don't have to name names because I understand there's probably some legal regulation around that, but have you had a time in your agency career that has been really extraordinarily challenging for you?
Yeah. Do you mean professionally challenging or personally challenging?
Well, I mean both. Because
I think that it's when guys get in trouble. That's when that's when it's the most personally challenging, you know. And when you know that the guy that you're looking after is at heart a really good kid, made a really bad decision, and is, you know, fear shitting himself, and is facing, you know, career ruin and not be, and that's the hardest, you know, that, and when you can't get guys jobs, you know, when they're coming to the end of their contract. And, you know, you know their wife, you know their kids, you know them, and you desperately want something to happen. That's when it's really challenging, I think. Professionally challenging, getting guys out of contracts is tough, but that's normally because they've got options, or because they don't have an option because of just where they're at mentally, and then you're really doing the right thing for them. I mean, it's tough work and difficult conversations, but I think rugby should have more difficult conversations. I think we're a bit tied to some of that stuff, and we just need to, you know, be a bit more honest about that. And if a guy's not liking it somewhere or isn't performing well somewhere, well, you know, these careers are pretty short. We should all be able to sit down and just go, hey, it's not actually working. Let's do something about it. But it's when guys are in trouble and when you can't get guys jobs, that's when you, you know, it literally keeps you up at night. Well, challenging.
As Stephen Donald is a friend of both of ours, and I remember, speaking of you and the personal touch, was it, I think we put this in his book actually, calling you up and making you think that he'd been put in jail in Sydney.
Sydney.
Tim Mickelson winding you up, yep. And you were just about to go jump on a plane to go and get the guy out of jail.
No, I'd smelt the rat, and I actually knew, because I'd rung around, and I knew he was playing with me, so then I turned it around and was playing on him.
But oh, perfect.
If I had to, I would have, but I rang Gav, his brother, and we pieced it, and Dallin or someone like that, and we pieced it all together, and we're like, he's just taking the
Does that happen a lot with your clients?
Only Beaver.
Just Beaver?
Yeah, just Beaver.
Yeah, and you're still finding him work. That's the worst thing of all. That is the worst thing of all.
Well, the book should have been better, and it should have sold more copies, mate. I didn't even have to.
Hey, mate, come on. We're pretty much sold out.
What can I do? Yeah.
Jesus, that's tough from you. You set me up on that. He's already done a movie. I have to write a book about the movie. And the movie was more about you too, by the way. This is the talk.
Hey. You said you'd be nice.
You wrote yourself into that movie
I did not.
You lived that though. That is one of surely the most extraordinary times of your professional life.
Yep.
Stephen has been a client of yours forever. You played rugby with Stephen, for goodness sake.
I generally watched him play while I was sitting on the bench.
Yeah. There was no way he was giving up his jersey for you. But, you know, I remember that World Cup and how he came back from that.
Yeah.
I mean, has anything ever touched that for you?
No, that was... The best bit was walking into the IRB Rugby Awards the next night and bumping into a suite of, well, you know, a pocket of New Zealand rugby writers and... one of them said to me, Stephen showed a lot of character. You know what I mean? So I got on my soapbox, gave him 10 minutes about how much character this bloke had, and that was probably the sweetest bit of the whole thing. Oh, yeah, I mean, it would have been a horrible way to go out, but he's just got such mental fortitude, and it was awesome to see. Who predicted it? Kahui or you? Or
I think we both had the same dream one night that he would, after he didn't get picked, that he would come back. Kick the winning goal. One of our producers at Sky keeps saying that you called that. It'd be the first thing I've called right in my life.
Yeah. To be fair to New Zealand Rugby Union, we'd try to get Beaver out early to get him up to Bath, and they just steadfastly refused. They said, no, we need 4 first fives available in the country.
Oh, what a gig. That must have been even worse, right? Yeah. I can't even move on. You've got me. You've got to hang in there.
Had to go out the beach and fish and get fat.
He enjoyed that. Where to next, Ports, you know, for your business and for you personally? I mean, is this... this obviously has longevity. The professional game's not going anywhere. But, you know, if there was one... futuristic prediction you could make for us before we say goodbye to you today, what would it be about what shape this game is going to take in the next few years?
It's probably, you know, New Zealand rugby is going to come under increasing, you know, an increasing number of challenges to keep up. And right now, I think they do a really good job of keeping, you know, the good All Blacks in the country. I think where the fall off is that sort of, you know, the guys that are on the bus but not on the pitch and aren't all that happy there, and there's a discrepancy around how they're remunerated to the other guys. So I know the NZR, you know, particularly their contracting team, will do everything in their power to be as novel as they can to, you know, we've seen the Quinns sort of stuff. No one really knows what that's going to look like or whatever, but they've always been prepared to innovate and be novel in ways to make sure that they keep guys in the game here. But with the, you know, the talk of the salary cap, you know, going up through the roof in the UK and the French, and who knows what rugby's going to happen in Japan.
And Japan's the interesting one here. I mean, Japan to me, and you've done a lot of work in Japan, your agency has too. I mean, it's never mentioned in dispatches. The money pouring through that club system is insane.
Yeah, their salary cap hasn't really marched on. So,
But they've been able to increase the number of foreigners who can be on the pitch.
Well, that's had the biggest impact this year in their uncapped players. Mm. So everyone thought this 5-year rule would have the opposite effect, but for some reason in Japan it's meant that there's an even bigger demand for uncapped players. So It's going to be constant challenge. The power is entrenched up in the north. Who knows what's going to happen with Super Rugby and the broadcast deal next time around? You know, we've seen some news today about the Rugby World Cup and who's going to be broadcasting that in New Zealand. You know, there's all these sort of really key pivotal moments coming up where things could be really good, or it could just add to the, you know, add to the issues that New Zealand rugby are, you know, really admirably trying to face.
Keep you busy too. Simon Porter, CEO of CSM. Thanks for joining us on the Short Ball today, mate. Great to get your insights into the game. That'll do us for another week. Make sure you enjoy all the action this weekend on rugbypass.com. Super Rugby, full round. Looking forward to it. Chiefs Highlanders, my game of the week. Surely it's yours too, Ports.
Of course.